and you look at the field strength coming off that antenna of my example, you'll think it's a 100-watt transmitter that's radiating isotropically. 100 watts going into a rubber duck instead of a real 10 dB gain antenna. So he's talking about megawatts of effective radiated power. The real power he's putting into it is kilowatts. But he's got 30 dB of gain, and it comes out megawatts. The real crazy thing about physics is the higher the gain of the antenna, the safer it is. One of the examples that I used to use is that I'm operating at 432, and I'm a really nasty guy. I'm going to put a kilowatt into an antenna, and you're going to decide, and I'm going to expose you to that antenna. I'm going to put you a small distance away from the antenna. A kilowatt of energy at 432 megacycles is going into the antenna, and you can choose which antenna I use. I can use a feed horn that goes in front of the antenna, in front of the parabolic dish. I put you a couple of feet away from the feed horn, or I aim the feed horn at the parabolic dish, where I now get 30 dB of gain. That's a 28-foot diameter dish, and now with a 1,000-to-1 power multiplication because of the antenna gain, I'm going to put you in front of that. Let me drop it. You try to calculate which is safer. Because the 28-foot diameter dish with 30 dB of gain is spreading that energy across 125 square feet, the 28-foot diameter, that's not 125 square feet, I think it is, because the signal coming off that parabolic dish is a collimated beam 28 feet in diameter, and you're only a couple of square feet standing in front of it, you only absorb a couple of percent of the energy. The majority of it goes by you, above you, below you, to the left of you, to the right of you. The higher the gain of the antenna when you stand near it, the safer you are. In the case of the feed horn, which is like a corner reflector, you can now get very close to a point source of energy, and a high percentage of it is being absorbed by you. So the higher the gain of the antenna, to some degree, the safer it is when you're nearby. So the megawatts that Eric is talking about sounds dangerous. It really isn't. Ain't that crazy? Let's see what Paul's got to add to all this with some questions. WS2N, and by the way, does NASA worry about the radio biohazard? By way of the let me drop it. NASA is very frequently putting tens of kilowatts of energy into their 230-foot diameter Goldstone dish when they're talking to, New Horizons or Voyager. Tens of kilowatts are going into a 230-foot diameter dish. And so the real power they're radiating is hundreds of megawatts and sometimes gigawatts of effective power. But only 10 kilowatts is really there, and it's being spread over an acre of antenna. You could literally lie down on the surface of that parabolic dish antenna, near the center of the dish, while it's aimed straight up in the air, talking to Voyager, while 10 kilowatts is being smeared across all of that surface. You could literally lay on the surface of the dish while it's operating, and you go through the calculation, you might be safe, even though it looks dangerous as all hell, because of this area relationship. The feed horn in that case is spreading the energy across that whole 230-foot diameter, and very little of that is really going to hit you. WS2N, I bet you're surprised by that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
I was just going to mention on the news a couple of days ago, Channel 12 had a story about Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York. He's going to get involved in getting all these dead spots on Long Island activated. He wants to make sure there's cell phone coverage throughout the island. So what he's going to do about it, I don't know. But, you know, he's got the position to try to do something. So he made a quick little speech, and he feels it would be safer. He's not sure how they're going to do it, if they're going to increase power or whatever. So he's kind of stormtrooping ahead to try to get the island covered. So that's a good sign. A lot of people don't have good reception in their homes. If they need to call for an ambulance or something, they're not going to get out, and they have to have a landline. They don't have a choice. So he's going to try stop to that. Let's see how it works out. Yeah, that's a question. I could go on and on. Yes, they consider it. I'll tell you about it later. Maybe with the what they did with Merritt Island down in Florida because of the 30-foot dishes that they had down there. What's involved? Back to you, Dick.
Comment on this subject again, Twill.
Yeah, I'm going to first address what Paul just brought to our attention. Rich, so stand by. Chuck Schumer is on the right wavelength. He's on the right. He's got a very good crusade here because, let's face it, a cell phone right now is a beautiful safety device. If you get involved in an automobile accident where your car on an icy day leaves the road, hits a telephone pole, the sheet metal gets bent up around you, you're trapped in your car and you're bleeding, and by way of the cell phone, emergency services can be rolling to you in seconds, maybe even 1 or 2 minutes. Emergency services are rolling to you. So as a safety device, a cell phone is beautiful. Therefore, Chuck Schumer is doing the right thing to make sure there are no dead spots. You want to make sure that if somebody has an accident in that area, he has cell phone coverage. Let me drop. It was either last week or the week before on the TechNet we discovered where Paul, because the guy, WS2N, was asking the question, what about these abandoned telephone poles? How do I get them removed? What we slowly discovered is that I used to think that you had to approach the town fathers of a particular town and get a permit to put up a utility pole in that area. Absolutely not. What we discovered is that the rules of telephone poles, of utility poles, they have carte blanche. They can put a telephone pole anywhere they want to, and the town, the mayor, and the town fathers, and the building department, and the highway department, they cannot stop that action. There are a number of communities on Long Island that have very poor cell phone coverage. All you have to do is hire a company that is qualified to put up utility poles. Tell them to put a utility pole in the middle of that dead spot. Then there are kinds of cell sites that are called microcell sites, is the word I use for them. You can put a microcell site on the top of a telephone pole, which will give coverage in that area. The dead spot goes away. And so a town that says, no, I don't want you putting any cell sites in my town, or when it comes to the full-blown or normally-looking cell site for reasons of what they think is biohazard or what they think is property values, they may be able to deny your petition to put up a full-blown cell site in that town. Let me drop it. But for Chuck Schumer to fulfill his requirement, all he's got to do is hire a company to put up a utility pole in the middle of that dead spot of the town that says, not in my backyard, and put a microcell site on it, and they can't stop that from happening. So those dead spots are going to be filled in by the left-handed rules of the carte blanche characteristic of utility poles. Ain't that crazy? I know you guys have got some further questions and comments and all of the above. Let's see what Rich has to ask about this. N2EO, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick N2EO. I'm sorry I came in late. I was taking a nap and I woke up around the time that the net was starting. Barry, N2MB, used to work for NBC TV. He worked at the 86th floor of the Empire State Building. And he told me they did a study because there was some concern about the employees getting sick from the RF radiation. I hate to use that word. But they did a medical study, and they found the people that were up there long-term for many years. the FM transmitter up there, the WYNY. It was a very nice experience and a good understanding. Back to that, Antonio.
Yeah, you could easily come to the conclusion that when you're on the 86th floor or whatever floor it was where all the transmitters are mounted at the Empire State Building, you're being bathed with RF. You can easily come to that conclusion. Let me show you why the word bathed in RF is overly sensationalistic and misunderstanding. The good radios that you and I use that are rich, a good handy-talkie, has a sensitivity of around a quarter or half of a microvolt. You're going to get a pretty good response out of that radio by the time you get up to 1 or 2 microvolts. Now you're getting to the point where you're going to get a dead, full quieting. So a microvolt of signal into a great old radio called Handy Talkie is going to give you a full response at 1 or 2 microvolts. Therefore, because all of those transmitters up there, the leakage from the cabinets, the signals coming off the antennas, looping back and coming back through the window into the building, you're going to get lots of signals above a microvolt. And therefore, your radio in your hand is jumping out of your hand. You try to call your local repeater when you're standing up there. Because of the overload of your radio, but all of those local transmitters, you'll have no trouble lighting up the repeater that's 30 miles away, but hearing the repeater into your handy-talkie in that environment is a real tough problem. Let me drop it. Now, let me show you the craziness of the numbers. Your radio is jumping out of your hand because it's seeing multiple signals that are above the microvolt level. The 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, that for a zillion years was considered a 10-to-1 safety factor safe for human beings. 10 milliwatts per square centimeter just happens to be 190 volts per meter of field strength. So the field strength that is dangerous to a human eye is around 190 volts per meter, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. That's where the threshold of danger of a human eye starts becoming a concern. Your radio only needs microvolts, not 190 volts. It only needs microvolts of signal, and it's jumping out of your hand. So your radio is telling you, hey, this is a real rich environment. Your radio has got 120 dB of gain between that antenna and the loudspeaker, and it's a very sensitive device. So therefore, when you're near a transmitter, you think that, oh boy, the way my radio is behaving, my body is really being cooked, and if I stay here for a couple of years in this occupation, I'm going to have all kinds of problems. You can see the numbers lead you to believe that what you think is dangerous is nowhere near as dangerous as you think. A guy who operates there, the strongest signal he's going to get is the leakage from the cabinet if he doesn't tighten down all the screws on the transmitter. Let me drop this. Eric recognized. So if the guy's doing the service on the transmitter, don't put the shielding cage back on and tighten down the screws. The leakage from the cabinet where he can stand a few feet away from that transmitter, that's probably the strongest signal he's going to get. And the signal that's actually going out the transmission line to the antenna, and the antenna in many cases is a couple of hundred feet above him on the tower of the Empire State Building. That signal, and with the gain of the antenna, you might have megawatts of effective radiated power. Really, kilowatts are going into the antenna, and it's going through a very well-shielded transmission line to an antenna 300 feet above you. So you think you're in a radio-hot environment. You've got to be careful how you judge that. In real volts per meter of field strength, compared to the microvolts your handy-talkie starts going bunkers, It can scare the daylights out if you don't understand the numbers. When you try to operate any of your equipment at that site at Empire State Building, Eric, I bet you've got some funny stories. That and possibly also with Glen Oaks, KE2EJ, K2RIW. Give us any of those war stories you'd like to, Eric.
Somebody on ILP that doesn't have their thing set right, that's why it's hanging their repeater up. Couple things. One, broadcast transmitters are designed not to leak. Right? you look at a VHF transmitter, like in the case of what Barry had. I think he had a lock in. That he's there after the World Trade Center, like Adam, from what I gathered, because he said he's on the 86th floor, not on the 81st floor where they were when the Trade Center went down. And eventually they moved up, and then eventually they even moved down. They're combined with Univision now. What's Univision or well, the other Spanish one? That's Telemundo, sorry. They're on the 79th floor right now. By the way, the transmitters are spread all over the building. I had my repeater up there, and I had to find a really good spot to put the antenna where it wasn't getting bathed in all that energy on the outside. Inside the building's not so bad, really. It depends upon where you are. Don't forget, that building is a steel structure that holds it up, but the building's made out of bricks. So that's not a very good Faraday shield, so you do get swamped, but I've measured, I have a couple of NERDA NERDA field strength meters, and we would go to the various different floors. Well, let me let it drop first.
And give us just a little bit more audio, Eric. There we go. Sorry about that, Dick. We would go to the various different floors and measure the field strength in the particular transmitter room. And for the most part, you could think that there was no transmitter there. Most of the energy is coming from the outside, from the antennas themselves, off the reflections of some of the structure, the way the antennas are mounted on Empire. That's why there's a number of hot spots on the observation floor. And the same was true with World Trade Center. What I will say is that the combiner room on 84, there's not a peep of RF looking at any of that stuff. All of those flanges are properly tightened to 120 inch ounces, and absolutely nothing leaks. I mean, truly nothing leaks. The descents that you get to is from the outside. If you go down to the 81st floor and hop around there with your AT, you can do pretty good. Go up three or four more flights, and it becomes more difficult. So, you know, the actual problem in both those buildings is really the antennas doing their radiation and reflections off of various parts of the building itself. At World Trade, when I had my repeater there, of course you put your transmitter antenna all the way up on the top. You can't hear a damn thing up there, so you put the receiver antenna at 108th floor. It was far enough below everything that you could actually hear, so that's the story. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I'm glad you corrected me, Eric. I should have said that hypothetically, if you left the screws loose on the shields of a transmitter, you could put some RF energy into the room. Nobody would do that for a whole bunch of reasons. You want full performance out of the transmitter, and you want it to be safe. So nobody is leaving the screws loose. I should have said that hypothetically, the strongest signal you're going to get in the transmitter room is from a leaky transmitter. If you did something really foolish, you were doing service on the transmitter, and you decided to temporarily put the shield back on the transmitter, if you know what I mean.
Nobody had a caveat to that.
Go right ahead, Eric. My guess is if anybody does service on the transmitter, there's somebody else looking over his shoulder to make sure that everything is restored to the original condition, to make sure the transmitter is giving you full performance. That's my guess. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
I gotta find out who's repeater system that is hanging things up here. One thing I will say is when we go and we look at, say, like an RCA TT30, which is an older transmitter, it uses a 4CX25000 or 24000. There's a 24 kilowatt transmitter analog. Those things were sealed up tighter than a drum. But came the late 70s, mid 80s to the early 90s as we went solid state, like the Larkin, would generate 1.5 kilowatts per board. The boards actually slid in, just, you know, plug in like you slide in. But because the the PC board is basically exposed and doesn't have a shield over it, there is a little bit of leakage, but we're talking about Sterling being able to measure milliwatts right up against the board, so. I mean, it's basically good design, but it's not as leak-proof, per se, as some of the tube transmitters, because, you know, you got it, even the FM transmitters, let's say 3CX3500, the PA is enclosed within a cavity itself, and that cavity is shielded, and, you know, you've got the plate voltage and the high voltage in there, so they go through all of that extra, making sure things are tight, more so for the high voltage aspect of it than the RF, but just coincidentally, because you've made a wonderful Faraday cage, you don't get the leakage. And, of course, in broadcast gear, we don't use little pieces of coax. It's this nice, big, fat hard line that is not your hard line, it's a 3-inch hard line. Actually, it could be 1 5/8, but, you know, what you draw in copper with real flanges.
Yeah, good information, Eric. So, leakage of the transmitter creating a danger for the local operators, very unlikely. Signal coming off the antenna, even though it's got kilowatts and megawatts of effective radiated power when you add the gain, sounds dangerous as all hell, and you're 100 feet away from it, so to speak. It's an antenna that's 100 or 200 feet above you, sounds dangerous, and the handy-talkie in your hand when you're at that transmitter site, the handy-talkie is wall-to-wall intermod because it's seeing so much local signal because the radio is so sensitive. It's looking for microvolts and fractions of a microvolt of a signal. And you and I are worried radio biohazard, radio frequency biohazard. We're worried about numbers like 190 volts per meter at the place where your eye is. And boy, you got to do something pretty foolish to get there. So as an attorney, you worry about 51 watts versus 50 watts coming off your VHF antenna. What I'm going to do for you, Ed, is I'm going to do the actual calculation for you. I'm going to assume you've got a transmitter that's either at 2 meters or 450. Let me drop. I'll do the calculation for 50 or 51 watts or 500 watts, assuming it's an antenna of known gain that you're likely to use at 450. I'll do a calculation for you is how many feet away are you going to be exceeding the numbers where you potentially are above the threshold where of concern for radio biohazard. It's going to be in the vicinity of 5 feet. And I'll also calculate for you what kind of an antenna you could use for sensing it and how many milliwatts or watts you're going to get into that antenna, which you then have to put into some kind of a calibrated watt meter or receiver with a calibrated S meter. So I'll do some numbers for you, but you're going to find out it's, unless you do something really foolish, like an antenna at eye level, you can't get anywhere near. There's going to be safety factors in most cases of 100 to 1 in the way you're likely to carry on rational ham radio. So it is an attorney at the commissioner of the FCC who added this new rule that we're responsible for. To answer one of your questions, let me drop it. I'll be amazed that even 1% of the ham radio operators do that calculation. In theory, we're all responsible for it. And so if we do a survey and we find out 1% of the hams are really doing it, or 0.1% of the hams, you would say, oh boy, we've got a dangerous condition here. Not really. When you get down to the real numbers, and once you understand that it is only the RF heating we're concerned with, and not with the word RF radiation. We're not being irradiated, if you know what I mean. We're not going to get a cancer from this. You don't get a cancer from radio energy. If you do something very foolish for numbers like 6 minutes at a time and longer, you're doing some extra heating of the cornea of your eye, and you're pushing the threshold of potentially developing a cataract and opacity in the eye, if you know what I mean. You know, that you cook the white of an egg and it's no longer transparent. Well, that's a little bit the way the cornea or the lens of your eye behaves if you cook it. And unfortunately, your eye does not have a very good sense of temperature. Therefore, your eye could be overheated and you might not get an alarm in your head at the time telling you, hey, my eye is running hot. your eyelid can sense temperature, your eye itself cannot. So therefore, there's a little bit of a danger to worry about. But I'll do some of those numbers, and you'll find out that do you have to worry about 50 or 51 watts? Not a chance. So the fact that a very small percentage are really doing it is not necessarily a dangerous condition. It came about because an attorney misunderstood the words. Therefore, he thought there's a potential danger here. Therefore, he came up with these sets of rules. That's how we got here from there. In my opinion, Ed, KC2PYD, good question. K2RIW in the deck net. Are you still with us, Ed? KC2PYD, K2RIW.
Can I have a comment?
I'm sorry, who's next? Were you guys calling in, Joe? KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey.
We're about to call you, Ed. I mean, Joe. I was turning it back to Ed, the guy who asked the original question. I thought he might have an additional question because we answered his question differently than the way it was asked for a whole bunch of reasons. Make your comment fairly brief, Rich. N2EO, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. I had a very good experience. Good memories when Barry brought me up to the NBC transmitter site. I think it was the 86 war, I'm not very sure. But that was at Empire. We came there at night. So we just pulled up to the building and parked the car. I'd like to know from Eric, this was in the 70s, would that have been to the two transmitters? Would they have been two transmitters? They were each running 50% power. They went to a combiner. Also, I'd like to know from Eric, it was a very small transmitter, the FM broadcast, WYNY. I'm very surprised it was so small. Back to that.
Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ. KE2IW.
You're going to have to tell me what he asked because I don't understand him. You know, it's my ears.
Yeah, he's basically asking in roughly 1970 when Barry N2MB brought him to Empire, he saw a pair of broadcast transmitters for NBC running at half power, supposedly, going into a combiner, and he saw another very small FM broadcast transmitter. He's asking, was that a tube-type transmitter being used at that time? I suspect it probably was. And so I think that was around the time that you were first coming on duty. KE2EJ, K2RAW, go ahead, Eric.
Did you say 1970s? NBC wasn't in Empire in 1970. They were at the World Trade Center. I don't know, maybe they still had a facility left there before they abandoned it, but that time frame doesn't work for me, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, maybe it was before World Trade. I know that you were doing Empire. Let's assume that it was 1968. What was the nature of the NBC transmitter in 1968 and the small FM broadcast transmitter that was in the same room that Barry was showing to Rich at that time? KE2EJ, K2IW, you think those were tube-type transmitters? I suspect they were.
No, at our time, RCA still existed, and everything NBC bought was had RCA on it. So that was probably a QT30. It'd be a 24 kilowatt, probably a 4CX24000, big, huge cabinet, and the power supply is an equally huge cabinet. They had two of them. That took up an awful lot of room. My familiarity with NBC and that Empire is after the World Trade Center, so that's a different game. Then the stuff that they had was solid state. And I think somebody said at WYNY, that station didn't exist in the 60s. That existed in, like, the 90s.
It may have been the laser, though, that was up there. I'm not sure. It was a small transmitter, WYNY, with a feed from, I guess, Rockefeller Center.
Kilo 1, Mike 2, yeah, Mike.
Was that Dick?
Blind thinks it was 1981.
Okay, we're hearing from Mike number 2. Mike number 2, go right ahead.
Doing, Dick. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to check in and say hello. I'm working from my mobile on the eastern shore of Virginia. I just wanted to say hello. I'm in my car.
Fantastic. Okay, we're getting some nice propagation tonight. I could tell because my over-the-air broadcast, Channel 2 and Channel 4, are not working very well tonight, so I know we're getting multi-bath, and digital television can't tolerate that. Very fine, Mike. He's the guy it's Mike number 2, who runs the second website, the LarmarkTechNet.com. Okay, we're keeping Joe waiting here pretty long. Joe, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. KQIW and TechNet. Wait for the beeps, and you've got it, Joe.
Barry just said it was 1981. Maybe you didn't hear him.
Yes, I did, but we got to go on. Go right ahead, Joe.
Hey, what's up, guys? What's up? Love you guys. Yeah, waited for the 4 beeps. And name here is Joe, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. All right, Dick, let's get to the point. My question to you is, I noticed that we only have field day like once a year. My question to you is it possible that we could do it like twice a year, like maybe every 6 months, like maybe have another field day in October? Yeah, because that would be really, really cool if we could do field day like twice a year. That's my question. Back to you.
Sure, field day.
Yeah, when it comes to the Radio Society of Great Britain, they have the equivalent of a field day, not quite the same way we do it, and they do a number of field days per year. In the United States, we only have one. Many of us call it the High Holy Day of ham radio, where for a 24-hour period, a little bit longer, we leave the family, we do outdoor camping, we get together with our buddies, and we operate field day. Supposedly, it's a competition. In reality, it's a way of testing our ability to operate under emergency conditions with not using ordinary power. We're using power generated and temporary setups of antennas and so on. And yes, it's a lot of fun. And because you're having so much fun when you go to field day, each year, Joe, you'd like to do it 2, 3, 4 times per year. Let me drop. However, you now have a pretty big campaign in front of you that would be required to do that, Joe. Because it is sponsored to some degree by the American Radio Relay League, the organization of ham radio in the United States, to convince that fairly conservative group of people that they should now be gathering the data, republishing it in the QST magazine, doing all the work that they've got to do for each individual field day to report on all of that, to convince them and to convince the ham radio population to do it 2 or 3 times per year. It is possible, but it's going to be a pretty uphill battle, I think, Joe. It would be a lot of fun. A certain percentage of the ham radio operation, the ham radio population, would be very much in favor of it. Could you convince enough of them to be in favor of it, that they start signing petitions, and they start petitioning the ARRL to do it twice per year instead of once per year? It's not going to be easy. I would be in favor of it, but this is because I'm one of the guys that really enjoys field day. You're one of the guys that really enjoys field day. Can you get the 50%, so to speak, of the ham radio population to interested, that they're willing to go away from the family that many times per year and do this great big operation and sign a petition. Can you get half of the radio population to sign a petition to, you know, might makes right, to demand that ARRL do this thing? Can you do it? It is possible, but I think it's going to be quite a bit of effort on your part, Joe, to sell the idea. I'm hearing it for the first time from somebody, and the idea sounds like an awful lot of fun, but it ain't going to happen just because you set
repeater, time out.
It's not going to happen just because you send a letter, one guy sends a letter to ARRL. They're going to need many thousands of letters or a petition with many thousands of signatures on it to make it happen, is my guess, Joe. KC2QIW, with a good idea, K2IW and the tech man. You got it, Joe.
N2RQ.
January.
Let's see what Lou's got to say. N2RQ, go right ahead.
Okay, thank you, Dick. My question is, what would be the purpose of having it more than once? It's a particular activity with a long history, but really, what are the characteristics that this gentleman is looking for? Because there may already be alternatives going as they are. For example, on September 24th, I think. September 24th, Limark is going to have a mini-field day operation set up in Levittown. And we've been doing that for a number of years. There are lots of other groups that do that sort of thing. Dick, and to RQ.
Your field day is in February.
Now, somebody keeps saying, blank field day is in February. Maybe he's talking about Radio Society of Great Britain. Lou, the mini field day in September, I'm guessing the purpose of it is to demonstrate to a particular library district, for instance, library district, what ham radio is like. It's a Limark advertising ham radio to the general public, is my guess. And when it comes to what is the purpose that Joe has in mind, Joe has in mind of having a whole lot of fun, because Field Day, yes, has a whole lot of history, and its main purpose, in theory, is to demonstrate the ability to operate under emergency conditions. But I think the majority of the participants of an ordinary field day are there because it's a darn much fun that they want to do it, regardless of what the reason is. I'm going to go back to Lou and then John in that order. N2RQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Lou.
Okay, all I was suggesting is we go back to the source of the proposal. What is his goal? And then we could look at what the various things are. And I'm not disagreeing with you. You know, I think I've done field day maybe 50 times. but there are lots of other things. And, yeah, we're going to be doing it under the same kind of emergency operation conditions that we would do for field day. We do a similar thing when we do it at the Cradle of Aviation Museum twice a year. So there are lots of different variations, and I'd like to know what his specific interests or goals may be.
And give us a couple words, Lewis. What is the reason and goal that Limark has a mini field day in September? What is the goal for Limark doing that? Over to you, Lou.
It's got two purposes. One is what you pointed out. It's a general public display. And the other thing is simply to practice the skills and have some fun. That's what we do ham radio for most of the time, if not in most cases all of the time. You know, there are lots of reasons for doing it. And I know individuals and clubs all over the country that do this at various times. My approach is when somebody asks a question that I don't fully appreciate, I go back to the source and say, what do you want? So go back to him.
147-375. Okay, let me check. 147-375 is operational. I'm hearing it right now. It sounds like I recognize that as the voice of Mike, WY2U. Mike, are you saying 375 is off the air? I'm hearing it. Okay. We're going to briefly go back to Joe. Joe, I'm guessing that you enjoy Field Day so much that you want to do it again. It's mostly for the enjoyment, I think, is your major motivation. Before I go back over to John, Joe, let me go to you first. Isn't that your general motivation? KC2QIW, you want to have twice as much fun. You got it, Joe.
Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You know, I'm all about fun and with friends and family and stuff. And, you know, it's very educational, too. And, you know, life is short, buddy. Life is short, so I'd rather do this, like twice a year, you know? Why wait a whole year to do it again? You know what I'm saying? Dick, back to you.
Dick, I might suggest the VHF contest. There's four of those a year.
Yeah, that I'm pretty sure was good old N2MB, Barry. And yes, he's absolutely right. We've got a VHF contest in January. We've got another VHF contest in June and September. We have a UHF contest in August. And so the serious operators go to mountaintops and fields and sometimes beachfronts for those VHF contests. And I'm sure you're pretty sure you've got a number of other, let me see, yeah, those, the serious operators do a kind of field day operation, a mountaintopping operation. Also the 10 gigahertz contest. There's one of those in August and one of those in September. And those are definitely done, 50% of the guys do it from mountaintops. And so that's a kind of field day on top of a mountain. So if you got heavy, let me drop. If you want to get heavy into the VHF and SHF operation, the 10 gig contest, we do have the equivalent of field day, a slightly smaller operation. I mean, the real field day in June is a big operation for many clubs. I'll admit that these other operations are a little bit smaller, but depending on how it's done, there's an equal amount of fun going on there, in my opinion. John, how many field days do they have on the County of Richmond, Staten Island? And I bet you, you've been involved in a few of those. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, that's for sure. A couple of them. KC2WGB. Dick, I just want to let you know, Jim from Toronto sent down a message in the chat room that check with the ARRL because he says there's one in the winter also, and it's ARRL, so it's probably for the States too. So that's where Joe should go and take a look on the website. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so either the chat room or whatever, Jim is VE3JIW from the Golden Triangle area near Toronto, Canada, giving us further information. Good stuff. So it looks like if you're willing to look into VHF operation as well as HF operation, there are other field day-like operations going on in the United States, Joe. KC2QIW, K2IW in the TechNet.
W2NDG Mobile. Comment.
Okay, W2NDG. I know you've signed in a lot of times, signed in quite a few times, but I'm so darn forgetful. Start with your name, sir, and your comment. W2NDG, K2IW. My name is Dick.
Quick, Dick, that's January 28th and 29th, the dates just came in, of 2017.
Okay, that's something to look forward to. Mr. NDG, start up with your name and go right ahead with your comment.
evening, Dick. Name is Neil, November Echo India Lima from Huntington, returning from a weekend trip upstate, been listening. So between the one station that's been very hard to hear and what John is saying, and just some things that I happen to pick up over the years, there is a winter field day, an official one. It's sanctioned. The thing is, it's not normally done in the northern states for obvious reasons, because of when it is. There's other things to worry about other than simply running your rigs off of generators. Obviously, we have to generate heat or have it someplace where you're not battling the elements. So, but it is done in a lot of other states. It's obviously up to each individual club. There's plenty of people who would love to do a field day twice a year. But if you ask the organizer of it, Mr. Paul Gomez from Limark, he probably wouldn't want to do it twice a year. We have to pick somebody else. Anyway, W2NDG Mobile, back to you, Dick.
Somebody is trying to say a comment, and it's an extremely noisy signal. Let me first go back to Neil. Neil, you said there is one in winter. I think you're talking about the January, I think it's called QSO Party. It's near the end of January, just barely away from the great big football weekend. So is it the January VHF QSO Party you're talking about as a winter-type field day operation, which a small percentage of very hardy guys will do a kind of field day operation on a mountaintop in the north, but I presume the majority of that participation is really in the warmer portions of the United States. So is that the one you're referring to, Neil? You just said there's one in the winter, but you didn't say what, where, and when. W2NDG, K2RIW.
Short repeater, timeout.
No, Dick, what I'm saying is what John is talking about, the dates at the end of January, and what there is a station trying to get in, and to that station you're very noisy, which is why nobody's been coming back to you. But I think if we all drop and let him speak, he's going to explain to us. There is an ARRL winter field day. It does exist. It's just not normally done in the northern states for obvious reasons. But I believe if someone in front of a computer wants to look that up, there is an ARRL sanctioned winter field day. That's all I was trying to say. W2NDG.
To work you?
I don't think it has that name, winter field day. I think it's called the January QSO Party, but there I'm not sure. Lou, go right ahead.
I am looking at the screen right now. It is www.winterfieldday.com, and it is called Winter Field Day. Now, I don't know that it's associated directly with ARRL because I simply Googled Winter Field Day, and this is what came up. So it's real, it's there, and I agree with what Neil said. I don't think most of us in this area would be willing to do it at the end of January. But of course, in the early part of February, second week of February, we have our second session, I guess the first session of the year, but the first second session of the school year, of the school club roundup, and you know, I'm a little bit involved with that in October and February. So anyway, I'm curious where Joe's located, and you know, maybe we can get together and play around with some of this. And I understand doing it on HF because you know, summits on the air and all of that stuff is great, but not everybody wants to go up on UHF. Or VHF. Back to you, send to RQ.
Copy Toronto, JIW Toronto.
Okay, QIW, the guy who asked the original question, he lives in Harrison, New York. And Jim, Mr. JIW, I'll bet you Canadians who are a little bit more hardy than we are, I bet you guys have the equivalent of a winter field day up there. VE3JIW, go right ahead, Jim. K2LIW in the deck, man.
WJB saw my entry in the text on the chat, but guys in Oakville Amateur Radio Club go outside, trailer generator, and they do winter field day. And the rules are different. I think you're allowed repeaters. I think in the winter field day, you're allowed to use repeaters for the 2 meter and the UHF. Different rules, but it is an ARRL event from what the web showed me. But yeah, they had, 10 Fahrenheit one night when they did it one of the last 2 years. They had 10 Fahrenheit with, you learn about generators, they ice up. But yeah, there are some hardy people who do winter field day in the north. Back to net from a, on a busy Sunday night. This is Jim, the E3JIW from Toronto.
Very fine, Jim. VE3JIW. When the temperature on a field day gets down to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, isn't that the time when you hardy Canadians first put on your sweater? Isn't that true, Jim? Go ahead.
Are the same latitude as South Dakota? We are not that far north. If you want to know brutal winter, Montana, Idaho, the Midwest, you know, the inland cities that get brutal, brutal weather. Toronto is only 44 degrees north. And we're sitting on Lake Ontario, which moderates temperature. So we don't get the brutal weather that the Midwest gets. And we're not as far north. Toronto is not as far north as some people think. Anyway, I mean, I think there's some place in Oregon where the same elevation. I'm not sure, latitude, I'm not sure of that, but I know about South Dakota. But yeah, there's great jokes about when we don our winter wear.
There's one other thing you said, Jim, that I'd like to hear a couple of words on. You said that at 10 degrees Fahrenheit, you had trouble with a freezing generator. Now, once the generator is started and running, I suspect that's not a problem. But if you start off with a generator that has been cold soaked for a day at 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and you try starting it the first time without using some form of heating of the motor itself, I suspect that could be a little bit difficult. Even if you use, maybe you have to use starting fluid. Give us a couple of words on the frozen generator at 10 degrees Fahrenheit, Jim. VE3JIW, Toronto, K2RIW in the deck nest.
I have had to start my generator in that type of, in that weather, with dead cold generator. It was outside with a plastic cover, a couple of boards. It was outside because my cousin who would have to use it was not able to wheel it outside. So it sat outside and it survived very well. Very old Honda, but no, it would be fourth or fifth pole in conditions when suddenly I needed it and I didn't have any pre-warning. No, the problem is the gasoline that is vaporized in the carburetor absorbs heat, and there is no carb heat in the generator, and the carburetor can ice. Automobiles have a way of taking air around the manifold to deliver back up to the carburetor. I'm going to trip properly. But the problem is you have no carburetor heat. You have the gasoline that is evaporating, and the exhaust is well removed from the carburetor. So that was the problem, that you can develop ice in the carburetor and it can stop the machine. I saw a snowmobile. We were on the lake and the guy was just barely running with a snowmobile. Opened up and it was just a ball of ice all around his carburetor. Air-cooled snowmobile, but you know, humidity conditions, running, it was just a ball of ice around his carburetor, and there was no water around. There was just snow. So yet, now lack of carburetor heat can be a problem as the engine continues to run.
Yeah, that's good information to know, Jim. That's something we don't consider. When Piper J3 aircraft. a Piper Cub aircraft. This was in the late 50s. One of the things that gets burned into your mind as a beginning pilot, whenever you slack off on engine power because you're about to lose altitude because you're preparing for a landing, you absolutely must remember to flip the switch that turns on carburetor heat. That takes some of the hot air from the air-cooled cylinders of the engine and directs it into the carburetor. Because if you don't turn on carburetor heat when you slack off on power and you're settling down to a lower altitude to get ready for landing, you can easily ice up the carburetor. It will stall the engine. And if you stall the engine before you've made your final turn into that airfield, you can easily end up landing in the woods, if you know what I mean. So that can be very dangerous. So we all forget about the fact that the evaporating fluid in a carburetor is creating an awful lot of heat of vaporization, it's called, 540 calories per gram. In the case of water, my guess is gasoline. Let me drop it. My guess is evaporating gasoline is not too different, so you get a lot of cooling, and if you haven't prepared for it with a carburetor heat of some kind, then you could have marginal operation of that carburetor in that engine. So special techniques are required for cold weather operation. Now, there was somebody with a very weak signal on a number of occasions who tried giving us information. We're going to stand by and see if we can get that signal through. So got right ahead with that person with the weak signal trying to give us information. Call letters, name, and then your information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2GJE, Ed, can you read me? Over.
We're reading you very well, Ed. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. Also, batteries are very unhappy at that temperature. I know in the service we used to have to start battery equipment in the middle of the night. But field day is a contest, and there are many of them. And everyone that goes out with their mobile, you're also operating under simulated emergency conditions, and God bless you all. Unless you want to get out in your boat and sail off to some foreign island and operate from there, you can have all the contest you want. But it's an expensive outlay, food, gasoline, and getting all the people that want to help and put their backs into it over.
Into our queue.
Go right ahead, Lou.
Well, you've been talking, and it's, all the stuff is interesting. I've been reading on the winterfieldday.com website. Apparently, it started in January of 2007, and they have three entry categories, indoor, outdoor, and home. And the indoor could be other than your home. But it's rather interesting. And certainly worth exploring. I haven't gotten far enough to see how many participants there are. But I have to take exception when you say field day is a contest. This goes round and round and round. Field day is an operating event in a contest format. And those of us who operate for the exercise, the learning, and the fun of it are not so much interested in the contesting. And there are others who only do contesting. There are definitely those two differences. And I've been on both sides of it. Even with the school club roundup, it's exactly the same.